is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight. South Africa temporarily suspends its rollout of AstraZeneca vaccine. 19 people die when bandits raid two villages in Nigeria's Kaduna State. And the U.S. and international partners are concerned of the delay of presidential and parliamentary elections in Somalia. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The African country most severely affected by the COVID-19 pandemic has temporarily suspended its rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine just days before its scheduled start. 1 million doses of the vaccine arrived in South Africa last week and were supposed to be given to highly vulnerable healthcare workers. 3 million more are due in the coming months. Darren Taylor reports.
South African scientists say their findings have important consequences for global attempts to end COVID-19. This is because a local trial of the AstraZeneca vaccine has shown it's not effective against mild or moderate coronavirus caused by the more infectious variant first detected in South Africa in December. The AstraZeneca shot, developed at Oxford University, is being rolled out around the globe. The principal investigator of the trial in South Africa, infectious diseases expert Shabir Madi, says the results are a reality check for the world.
We've been somewhat euphoric of the early results that were reported for COVID-19 vaccines, when vaccine efficacy was being reported as being 95%. And all of that vaccine efficacy was not against the variant that circulates currently in South Africa and that has now dispersed throughout the world. It is time, unfortunately, for us to recalibrate our expectations of COVID-19 vaccines, as well as how we go about deciding to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic, both in South Africa as well as globally.
Madi says COVID-19 is likely to continue to evolve as it tries to outwit vaccine after vaccine.
This has got tremendous implications. It's got implications in terms of what we can expect when it comes to future resurgences from the virus, in terms of how long the virus will continue, and for all intents and purposes, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, COVID-19, is likely to be with us during the course of our lifetimes. It's unlikely a virus that is going to be eradicated anytime soon.
Madi says he's very disappointed, but remains optimistic that the AstraZeneca vaccine will still have a role to play in combating the variant.
What I need to emphasize again at this point is that two-thirds of the COVID-19 cases in this particular study were due to mild infection, and the other one-third were due to moderate illness. So what this data don't tell us is whether or not this vaccine might still protect, at least against severe COVID-19, especially individuals that are at high risk of developing severe disease.
Scientists say protection against severe disease is valuable because it keeps people out of hospital and from dying. Health Minister Zweli Mkhize hopes the AstraZeneca vaccine will still soon be given to healthcare workers, a move that will, in effect, test its ability to protect them from severe illness caused by the variant. A vaccine that's already proven effective in this respect is made by Johnson & Johnson, known as J&J. Mkhize says South Africa's vaccine rollout will begin very soon.
We will have increasing numbers of vaccines that will be coming from the two, which is Pfizer and J&J. We are also still in negotiation with a whole number of other vaccines. There are discussions going on Sputnik V. There are discussions going on the Sinopharm. There are discussions that are going on with Moderna. And we will also...
Most of the jabs on the minister's radar are, however, untested against the variant. At this stage, say South African scientists, attempts everywhere to get herd immunity against COVID-19 won't succeed because the virus is mutating all the time. In the future, they say, unless there are major medical advances, people will continue to get infected with COVID-19, although there will be far fewer deaths. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera says the country will go ahead with acquiring the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine, despite concerns about its efficacy. Chakwera on Sunday evening announced Malawi has acquired 1.5 million doses and that additional ones were on the way to vaccinate a total of about 4.5 million people. Chakwera said Malawi, one of Africa's poorest countries, settled for the AstraZeneca vaccine because it is cheaper. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In a revised address on the fight against COVID-19, President Chakwera said the vaccine type coming to Malawi has an average of 60% to 70% efficacy. He said although the efficacy is lower than other vaccine types, the AstraZeneca vaccine has one great advantage over the other vaccines.
At $4 a dose, it costs 2.5 times less than the two other vaccine types, 4 times less than a third type, 5 times less than a fourth type, and 8 times less than a fifth type.
However, South Africa has decided to put a hold on the AstraZeneca vaccine jabs after studies showed that it gives minimal protection against the COVID-19 variant that is currently circulating in the country. Prior to widespread circulation of the more contagious variant, the vaccine was showing efficacy of around 75%, but health officials say in a later analysis of its strength against the new variant shows a 22% efficacy rate. President Chakwera announced last week that Malawian scientists had confirmed that the country now has a more contagious new strain of the virus from South Africa known as 501Y.V2. In his address Sunday, Chakwera said the country's rate of infection is too high.
Over the course of this past week, 2,987 new infections were confirmed by our testing facilities across the country. This represents a 22% positivity rate. And while it is lower than the 29% positivity rate from last week, it is still higher than the 0 to 5% rate that we are aiming for.
Dorothy Ngoma is former president of Malawi's National Organization of Nurses and Midwives. She said Malawi should take vaccine with caution.
Because we have both viruses raging in our country, there's still an advantage to be protected from the first virus. Probably that's the one which was put at 75%. And if that is correct, then it makes sense as long as this is a gift.
Ngoma said the government would consider buying vaccines with more efficacy rate once they have got money to do so. Social commentator Humphrey Mvula disagrees.
Life is not cheap. We'll not compromise on the price of the vaccine, which does not address the concerns that we have on COVID-19. We should be able to, based on the experience of South Africa, we should be now engaging our scientists, medical experts, do an analysis of the strain that is prevalent in Malawi, and then advise government accordingly.
The chairperson for the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19, Dr. John Puka, said Monday that the task force would soon make its decision on whether to proceed with the AstraZeneca vaccine rollout based on findings about its efficacy on the new strain of the virus. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken thanked Stephanie Williams, the acting U.N. Special Representative in Libya, for advancing peace, resulting in a nationwide ceasefire agreement, selection of leadership for a new executive authority, and the decision to hold national elections by the end of this year. A State Department spokesperson said the UN-facilitated process will lead to a stable, secure Libya. Wolfgang Pochtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, explains the U.S. position and the latest Libyan developments to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi.
As it is the case since years, the United States continues to support the UN-led stabilization process for Libya. I don't expect any changes or major initiatives on its own by the United States in the near future. Stephanie Williams certainly deserves this appreciation. She took over in March 2020, you will remember, at the height of the battle for Tripoli. Last summer, when the battle for Tripoli was decided and the stalemate took place in the area of Sirte, she used the opportunity to what was, in fact, an entirely new diplomatic initiative and not as claimed by some diplomats, a continuation of the so-called Berlin process. And with an exceptional persistence and after several setbacks, she established a so-called Libya Political Dialogue Forum, LPDF, process and managed to get the public acceptance, or at least the tacit agreement, of most of the Libyan and international stakeholders. Although, remarkably, the LPDF is by no means a legitimate representation of the Libyans. Now, she ended her term as an acting UN Special Representative with the nomination of a new Presidential Council and the Prime Minister by this LPDF. Actually, she achieved by this probably much more than her predecessors, but of course under more favorable circumstances. This means if the Presidential Council and the Prime Minister are confirmed by Libya's rival parliaments, Libya will have in the future only one government instead of two, which is indeed a remarkable success and eventually a turning point. History will tell us if this turning point will lead to the better or to the worse.
The UN process known as the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum managed to choose an interim authority to oversee Libya as part of an effort to rebuild state institutions and lead to national elections planned for December 24. What are the major challenges that could encounter the elected presidential council and the interim prime minister?
For the time being, legitimacy comes only from the non-elected Libya Political Dialogue Forum. Confirmation by the rival parliaments is likely, although some members of the House of Representatives, the Eastern Parliament, feel somehow blackmailed by Williams, because if they do not agree, the new government and presidential council will be endorsed by the Libya Political Dialogue Forum itself anyway. The key challenge is right now for the new government to get acceptance from the key Libyan stakeholders beyond the lip services. All of them gave these lip services during the last days. A challenge could be the past of the Baba. This could be a source of troubles. His history as a member of the close of the inner circle of Saif al-Islam, his alleged involvement in corruption, money laundering, financing the Muslim Brotherhood, vote buying, and so on and so on. Regardless if this is true or not, it's all about perceptions. A major issue is certainly the lack of representation of the capital Tripoli, the Cyrenaica, and the Arabs and Toubou in Vezan in the Presidential Council. The Eastern Al-Manfi and Al-Koni from the south are not widely accepted as representatives from their regions. We have now five bodies, the LPDF, the Presidential Council, the government, the House of Representatives, the High Council of State, with unclear competences. There is no legal framework for the elections, and it is not clear who needs to agree on it. How to get the people to the ballot boxes? The participation in the recent round of local elections was actually remarkably low, about 23%, while only about 40% of those eligible to vote registered. What will happen with the myriad of militias, especially in the greater Tripoli-Misrata area, who all believe that they are legitimate? Congratulations came from everywhere, but the expectations on the new government are very different. In part, actually, diametrically opposed. So much will depend on how the Baba approaches the many problems and, most important, how he tries to win the trust of those who don't feel represented. I would not bet that the elections will really take place in December. And if they do, I'm not sure that they will be held in an orderly manner.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. 19 people were killed when armed men raided two villages in northeastern Nigeria's Kaduna state over the weekend. These armed men, called bandits by locals, according to the French news agency AFP, often raid villages in the area, stealing cattle, kidnapping for ransom, and burning homes after looting supplies. The state's Internal Affairs Commissioner said the bandits, riding on motorcycles, looted the village of Kutenshi Saturday and killed 14 people. On the same day, according to the official, the gunmen stormed the village of Kujeni, where they killed 5 people and burned several houses, warehouses, and a church. These kidnapping and cattle rustling gangs maintain camps in the Rugu Forest, straddling Nigeria's Kaduna, Katsina, Zanafura, and Niger states. The gangs have no ideological leanings, but the AFP points out there are concerns they may be gradually infiltrated by jihadists from the country's northeast. The International Crisis Group says since 2011, violence in Nigeria's northwest region has killed 8,000 people and displaced 200,000. COVID-19 isn't the only epidemic that Nigeria is fighting. The public's perception of corruption continues to spread despite the ongoing war against graft by President Buhari's government. Gifta Gariga from Abuja, Nigeria, examines the impact of the 2020 Transparency International Corruption Perception Index rating, which saw the country drop another 3 places on the global list.
Corruption has been adjudged one of the major problems confronting Nigeria since independence. Buhari government has made fighting corruption a top priority, but many Nigerians are wondering if the effort is genuine, given their daily contact with graft and the corruption perception index's status light. Anwar Musa Rafsanjani is Executive Director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center and Head of Transparency International, Nigeria. He says Nigeria's fall on the group's annual list is worrisome.
It is worrying that despite the numerous efforts by the state actors on the war against corruption, Nigeria is still perceived by citizens and members of the international community as being corrupt. And this clearly speaks to the fact that the effort is not commensurable or is not really appreciable to the results.
Rafsanjani urged the government to examine what drives the country's deteriorating image on graft and consider how to change it. The chairman of the Presidential Advisory Committee Against Corruption, Professor Issei Shage, said the rating was deliberately done to put the country in a negative light.
Certainly it's not a new blow, and I'm not surprised, because this is the whole thing is a setup. The developed world is supposed to have a bad report to establish that we are not developed. But we know what we have achieved as a country. It's tremendous, at least in the last 5 years. Yes, we're very proud of that one.
Officials have always criticized the yearly reports, saying Transparency International was oblivious of the achievements of the Buhari government. Chairman of the Buhari Media Organization, Nii Akinsuju, rated the government high in his fight against graft.
In terms of the fight against corruption, it is obvious to anybody who is an objective follower and observer of what this government has been doing precisely since 2015. For the first time, we have seen actual policy deployment to engage, corruption, and of course, to redefine the government capacity to fight off corruption.
Dr. Sam Amadi is the director of the Center for Public Policy and Research in Nigeria. He says the rating reflects a rising perception of corruption in Nigeria.
I'm not really surprised at the fact that Nigeria is rated one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The rating by the Transparency International is always accurate about Nigeria. Nigeria's corruption index reflects what it is, which is the perception of corruption has increased. And perception is critical. We are dealing with corruption as an epidemic.
Nigeria is now the second most corrupt country in West Africa with this current ranking. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga in Abuja.
Somali opposition groups have vowed not to recognize the leadership of President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo's government after his four-term in office expires today. Somalia's international partners, including the U.S., have raised concerns about the ongoing impasse in the country regarding the delay of presidential and parliamentary elections. Some experts worry about security setbacks looming. Mohamed Kayi reports from Mogadishu, Somalia, for VOA News that the coalition of opposition presidential candidates, through their spokesman Redwan Haji, said they will no longer recognize Farmajo as head of state. However, some members of parliament believe the president is legally in the office until his replacement is chosen. Human rights activists fear COVID-19 increases the risk that millions of women and girls may be subjected to female genital mutilation. They are calling for an end to the barbaric practice on this International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than 200 million girls and women alive today are suffering the physical and mental consequences of female genital mutilation. FGM involves the partial or total removal of external female genitalia. It is mainly practiced in 30 countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, mostly between infancy and adolescence. Leading United Nations agencies and human rights activists warned the COVID-19 pandemic puts girls at great risk of FGM, which thrives in isolation. They note lockdowns and school closures make girls particularly vulnerable to abuse. Without urgent action, they say 2 million more girls could be at risk of FGM over the next decade. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says this is in addition to the more than 3 million girls potentially facing the practice every year.
Let's be clear. Female genital mutilation is a violation of human rights and has no medical benefit. It can result in complications and health risks that can have both short and long-term health and social effects on women and girls. We must stop FGM, and we must ensure that no health worker performs it ever.
WHO reports immediate complications from FGM can include severe pain, excessive bleeding, tetanus and other infections, shock, and death. Long-term complications can include urinary, vaginal, and sexual problems. FGM can lead to complications in childbirth and newborn deaths. This harmful practice is known to cause psychological problems such as depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. A UN action plan for eliminating FGM by 2030 will cost around $2.4 billion to implement over the next decade. To put this large amount of money in perspective, the UN says the cost of protecting girls from this violation breaks down to less than $100 per girl. A WHO study in 27 countries has found the economic costs of treating health complications of FGM comes to $1.4 billion a year. This amount, it says, is expected to rise to $2.3 billion a year in 30 years if FGM prevalence remains the same. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Democratic Republic of Congo reported the first fatality of another Ebola outbreak in the country's violence-racked northeast. Fighting in the area led to the second deadliest outbreak of the virus to drag on for 2 years. It's the fifth outbreak in the last 4 years in the country and raised concerns about controlling the deadly disease, particularly as it also deals with the second wave of the COVID-19 coronavirus. Officials say the most recent case was the wife and a farmer who survived Ebola. Medical personnel are trying to trace who she may have come into contact with. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Paro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.